Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Ken Cook. Ken Cook is co-founder and president of the 1.3 million member Environmental Working Group, or EWG. With a focus on toxic chemicals, air and water pollution, and industrialized agriculture, and on solutions to many of the major problems of our days, EWG's research and analysis have empowered millions of people. They've changed policy at the USDA, the FDA, in the halls of Congress, and even in the White House. They've blown the cover on who's really benefiting from hundreds of billions of dollars in farm subsidy money funded by U.S. taxpayers. And they've done the research to tell us what foods are contaminated with pesticides, GMOs, and dangerous chemicals, and more importantly, how you can protect yourself and your family. So now, Ken, my dad and I are so grateful to have this time with you. And for the interview, I'm going to hand it over now to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean. And thank you, Ken, for being with us once again.
My pleasure.
There's a widespread belief that since there now are 7 billion of us, 7 billion human mouths to feed, we can't afford the luxury of organic farming. And the only people who think that we can, who think organic agriculture could feed a world with so many of us in it, are delusional hippies or hysterical moms or self-righteous organic farmers. But there are actually a great many agribusiness executives, agricultural and ecological scientists, and international agriculture experts who believe that a large-scale shift to organic farming could indeed feed the world, particularly if we cut back on the amount of meat in our diets. What's your perspective on this very important question?
Well, it's one I get all the time, John, and thanks for asking it. You know, I'm tempted to get to the bottom line, which is I wonder if we can feed the world any other way than organically in the long run. So let's pick the question apart a little bit. First of all, are we feeding the world now? Well, we're feeding people, by and large, who have access to food and can pay for it. But for those who don't have access, for those who don't have the money to pay for it, the reason they're hungry is not because of the supply of food. There's usually plenty of it, including plenty of it usually in proximity to people who are, in fact, starving. But they can't buy it, and they don't have the means to produce it themselves. We produce more than enough calories around the world now in terms of raw food production to make everybody have a full tummy, but it's not produced in ways that are equitably distributed or where access is fair and equitable. Secondly, we're producing a huge amount of crop mass, corn and other crops in particular, that we either feed to livestock or we are turning into ethanol or other industrial products. If we took that same amount of land and devoted it to fruit and vegetable production, production of leaner cuts of animal protein, and otherwise reconfigured our system, we could readily feed the people on the planet now and in the foreseeable future. But we would have to make some adjustments in industrial agriculture. So as I look at the problem, I just look, first of all, in the U.S. domestic context. We produce only about 15 million acres of fruits and vegetables in this country right now out of a billion acres of land and farms. So if we wanted to make sure that everyone's plate was, as USDA says, occupied one half with fruits and vegetables and whole grains and so forth, we would have no difficulty providing an adequate diet with probably fewer than 50 million of those billion acres. It's how you use the land. It's what you're growing and why you're growing it. That is really the underlying question. From a production standpoint, we could produce plenty of food to feed the world, and we could produce it with fewer energy inputs, with less pesticide, with less hormones and antibiotics, if we chose to do so. But industrial agriculture has such a grip on the system now, and has had since the 1950s in the United States and then more recently in other countries. It's very hard to, in many cases, disentangle this rhetoric about feeding the world as a marketing ploy by these big agribusinesses versus feeding the world as we think of it in terms of real human need.
Agribusiness creates a lot of confusion. Agrochemical companies and their spokespeople are always saying that we need pesticides to feed the world. These are companies that profit from the sale of pesticides, but they talk as though they speak on behalf of the world's hungry.
And, you know, Frances Moore LePay, Anna LePay, her daughter, so many, you yourself have written so eloquently about what the real food economy would look like if only we put the needs of people first as opposed to the needs of the companies that are built to maximize production using so far unlimited amounts of energy, water that's been wasted to a fare-thee-well, fertilizer inputs, insecticides, and so forth. All of that system is premised on the notion that you want to maximize the production of industrial crops, not premised on the notion that we need to feed the world, because that would look like a very different food system, very attainable. And I think it could be done organically. In the long run, looking at the stress on the planet from everything from soil erosion, fertilizer runoff, abuse of antibiotics and hormones, pesticides, when you add all of that up, the waste of water, what you really want to do is try and develop a system that rewards economical use of natural resources, doesn't create more problems than it solves, doesn't pollute the Midwestern groundwater and surface water with pesticides that we then have to either clean up or just drink for the sake of overproducing crops that we already have too much of. If you really got the signals straight and aimed at feeding the world, we would have a very different agriculture. And I think the organic way of thinking, the way of thinking that's organic, it's brain power, it's working with nature, it's how to do that in a way that is sustainable.
When you speak of an organic way of thinking, I'm reminded of a recent, widely read article by a woman named Melinda Moyer that was titled Organic Schmorganic. It was originally published on Slate.com, and I'm sure our listeners would agree that you're better off eating fruits and vegetables, even if they're not organically grown, rather than eating heavily processed snacks and candies, even if they are. But Melinda Moyer, in her article, goes further, and she dismisses organic food as essentially an expensive fad and explicitly tells parents not to worry about pesticides. She mentions, in particular, EWG's Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce. But mainly, she mentions it to critique it quite harshly through quotes from people who are actually pesticide industry consultants. It doesn't appear that she spoke with any of the scientists, any of the many, many scientists who have very serious concerns about the risks that pesticides pose to children. Yet her article, Organic Schmorganic, has gone completely viral. It's being widely, widely read. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, we responded to that article by speaking to some of the very scientists that have done pioneering work looking at the risks that pesticides pose to children and the rest of us, but specifically to children. Experts like Dr. Philip Landrigan, who's the Dean of Global Health and the Director of the Children's Environmental Health Center at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And Phil has been at the forefront of scientific work trying to explain to people that when you look at pesticides, you have to look at all of their properties, all the ways we're exposed, and you have to look at the fact that children are not little adults. The doses that they receive are far in excess per unit of body weight than we do. So as we read her story, I think there was probably a core group of people out there who are predisposed to think that organic doesn't mean anything, and for various reasons they've dismissed the benefits of it. But when you look at scientific authorities, when you look at the way we regulate pesticides in this country, it's pretty clear, John, that there is good reason to be concerned about pesticide residues in the food supply and drinking water, in the air when pesticides are used in homes and in commercial settings to deal with insects and so forth and so on. But the main thing that really comes through to me is that I think consumers are way ahead of the skeptics and are driving the growth of organic food production simply because they've concluded that they really can't trust the government, and they certainly can't trust pesticide companies and their hirelings when they say that everything is perfectly safe.
Have there been pesticides that have been approved and then widely used, and then data becomes overwhelmingly convincing that they're dangerous poisons and particularly dangerous to children, and they really never should have been approved in the first place?
We have countless examples of pesticides that have been on the market, in some cases for decades. And one day, lo and behold, the Environmental Protection Agency comes out and says, well, this pesticide is going to be phased out now. We've come to an agreement with the manufacturer. We're going to phase it out because it appears that there could be excessive risk to children in the food supply from these pesticides. And so we'll be moving on to other ways of dealing with the pest problem. Well, what that really means is this. There are any number of pesticides that right now are in regulatory jeopardy at either the EPA, our agency at the federal level, or in similar agencies around the world, where science is beginning to catch up and determine that the exposures that children and others are experiencing day in and day out through dietary exposure, through drinking water, through air, residential use of insecticides, fill in the blank, that there's reason to believe that the risk is excessive. And so time and again, consumers wake up to news that something that they've been eating for decades and been told by the government and by pesticide companies is perfectly safe, bingo, all of a sudden is going off the market because the government's finally determined that it's not safe. And consumers remember that. When you ask consumers, in fact, when they've been asked for decades now what one of their top food concerns is, a preponderance of them say, pesticides. I think that the initial main concern in the food supply is probably food safety, food poisoning that can, in fact, lead to death, as we know, when the wrong kind of bug in food is allowed to grow and contaminate someone who has a compromised immune system, an infant, an elderly person can literally lose your life. Not so with dietary exposure, in most cases, to pesticides. But consumers do know that these are poisons that are used to abet food production in industrial settings, that some of these poisons are left in the food, and they are aware that over time the government has concluded that pesticides deemed safe for decades, and we've been given assurances by the companies that use the pesticides to grow produce or other foods. We've been given assurances by the companies that make the pesticides that everything's safe, and then all of a sudden one day they're not. That, I think, is what gives consumers pause when they read articles such as the one that you referenced. And that's why, you know, we have thousands of people at the EPA now whose job it is to regulate pesticides. That's not because they're inherently safe. It's because there are risks. That's why we conduct studies of pesticide safety. It's not because we're worried that rats will get cancer. We're worried that long-term exposure to humans could result in excess cancers in the population.
I think many people today are skeptical about the safety of pesticides, and rightly so. And they're voting with their dollars. They're making their feelings quite clear by what they will buy and what they won't buy.
So I think the final test of this is when consumers decide of their own free will what risks they want to take and what risks they want to avert, more and more of them are choosing organic. The market for organic is growing dramatically. The market for conventional foods in this country is pretty flat. And I think the reason is consumers are seeing organic as a way that they can invest in their health and the well-being of their families. Day in and day out, we read stories of some new study that's popped up It might be a study in Europe or a decision by a European regulatory body. It might be something that's come up here in the United States or elsewhere around the world where someone, an agency, a group of scientists have said, we're concerned about this pesticide, neonicotinoid insecticides, the ones that may be implicated in the loss of bees. There's concern now that very low levels of that in food might be posing a risk, a neurodevelopmental or neurological disease risk to human beings. Once people begin hearing these things, what they basically conclude is, you know, until scientists make up their mind, until they fight their way through the lobbyists to make a decent regulatory decision, I'm just going to take the step that makes sense, which I'm going to avoid pesticides whenever I can, and organic is the way to do it.
Well, there is an increasing market and increasing consumer demand for organic food, despite the fact that the high price of organic food can irritate anyone. I don't think there's anything inherent in growing food organically that makes it more expensive, but we do have a perverse system of subsidies, taxpayer-funded subsidies, that support agrochemical-based agriculture rather than organic. And then we add insult to injury by charging organic growers to prove that their crops have indeed been grown without pesticides, which to me is like getting fined for wearing your seatbelt. The high price of organic produce is presently an insurmountable obstacle for some people. Where should someone who wants to avoid these poisons start? Are there baby steps that you would recommend?
Well, there's one thing you can do with respect to fruits and vegetables, which is consult EWG's Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce. What we did with this guide, and it's free online at EWG.org, we looked at USDA's most recent data, and we do it every year, we update it, and we try and tell people which fruits and vegetables have the most residues and the highest amounts of residues of different kinds of pesticides. It's a fairly straightforward calculation. It doesn't take into account the toxicity of specific pesticides and so forth. That's very difficult to do across lots of different pesticides and lots of different health effects and biological activity. But what we do is we just sort of tally it up and say, okay, these fruits and vegetables tend to have lots of pesticides on them of different kinds. So this is a good category of produce, like typically apples, oftentimes strawberries make the list. These are the ones where, if you can, try and buy organic. Not everyone can find it. Not everyone can afford it. I mentioned my friend Phil Landrigan a few minutes ago. Phil is the person who observed one time that organic is like private school for food. And in a way, it is. But our list also gives you what we call the clean 15, the fruits and vegetables that, according to USDA's own laboratory tests, end up being very low in pesticides just because of the nature of the crop that's being grown and how the pesticides are used on it. Bananas, for example. There's a lot of pesticide that's used on bananas, and that's a risk to the workers in the field where those bananas are produced. But even conventional bananas have very low pesticide inside them when they're peeled. A lot of fruits and vegetables absorb pesticides regardless of whether they're washed and peeled, but others, it turns out, the pesticides applied early in the growing season, or it's a type of pesticide that degrades very rapidly, so there isn't much residue. So you've got the Dirty Dozen that we come out with a list of every year where we recommend people try and buy organic whenever they can, and we've got the Clean 15 where go ahead and buy conventional. There's a much lower risk of pesticide exposure simply because of the way the foods are grown and the types of pesticides used. But to go back to something you said before, John, we have always said at EWG, if it comes down to snacking on a conventional apple versus a bag of Cheetos, this is a no-brainer. You want to eat the conventional apple. The dangers of eating too little fruits and vegetables, not enough produce, those dangers are much greater than the dangers of the pesticides in conventional produce. So you want to keep eating those fresh fruits and vegetables, but if you're concerned about pesticides, and most people are, there's some easy ways, in addition to buying organic, there's some easy ways to shop for conventional fruits and vegetables that are lower in pesticides.
I'm sure many of our listeners would also like to know how their elected officials are voting on food policy issues. and if there's a way how to hold them accountable on a wide range of food and farming topics, including organic issues. I know you are involved with Food Policy Action and the National Food Policy Scorecard. Can you tell us about those?
I'd love to, and thank you for walking us out of the supermarket aisle and the farmer's market and into the halls of Congress. Not everyone will be following us, John, but it's so important that we talk about this. So many problems with our food system originate not with hardworking farmers or not with well-meaning wholesalers and supermarkets and food companies, but originate with Congress, where there's meddling with food policy in almost every imaginable way. And a few years ago, a small group of us got together and started thinking about our common problem. You know, groups that were working on anti-hunger programs found themselves under attack from conservatives who were arguing that anti-hunger programs were a ripoff, that were mostly being abused by cheats and through loopholes. People working on ideas to improve the welfare of farm animals were being frustrated by lobbyists and their representatives in Congress who didn't want to change industrial agriculture and particularly animal production in factory farms. Same with pesticides, same with farm subsidies. Name the issue in the food system, and we're all coming up against this political problem. Well, decades ago, the environmental movement came up with an approach to try and deal with this. They banded together, the groups that were working on federal legislation, and formed something called the League of Conservation Voters. And one of the first things the League of Conservation Voters did was to score members of Congress by keeping track of all of the votes on the floor, the full votes by the full House of Representatives and the full Senate, keeping track of those floor votes that were important to the environmental movement. Now, we all work in our silos. We can't all work on everything. Environmental Working Group is engaged in a lot of different issues, from anti-hunger programs, the SNAP program and school lunch, straight through to farm subsidies and pesticides. But we don't cover the whole spectrum of issues that are important to the food system, but our colleagues do. So we asked ourselves, well, how can we work together to make food in a good way political? How can we really help people understand how their member of Congress, their member in the House, their senators, how they're doing when it comes to food, which is so important to us, the ultimate, most neglected kitchen table issue, if you will, literally. And we decided that even though we weren't experts, each of us, in all of these realms, at the values level, John, we all agreed. No child should go to school or to bed hungry at night. Animals should not be mistreated in farm settings in order to provide us cheap meat. We should have a farming system that makes the environment better, improves it, not causes it to be degraded by soil erosion and runoff in our streams and lakes and loss of wildlife habitat. We ought to have a food system that pays the people who work in it a fair, decent living wage. We ought to be able to make sure that our food supply is safe. At the values level, all of these organizations, all these individual leaders agreed. So what we decided to do was let's look at the votes in Congress and see how many of the House and Senate floor votes really affect the food system, and we were stunned. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of votes over the years that when you added it all up, you did have a political profile, member by member, of how they stood on food. So we launched 2 years ago Food Policy Action, a national 501c4 organization. Foodpolicyaction.org is the website. And we published now two comprehensive national food policy scorecards where we've looked at the most important votes based on the judgments of some of the most expert lobbyists working on our side of things, on the food movement side of things in Washington, their judgment, what they think constituted an important vote. We've really put together a stellar group of experts who, speaking at the values level, have decided that it's time for the food movement to become political in a good way, to make sure that voters know, if they're concerned, if they want to know, before they go into the voting booth, how their member of Congress, how their senator, how their representative did on food, and one single source where you can go to get a good snapshot of that.
Well, we thank you for that, and I know all of our listeners will be, or most all of them will be, very interested in this. it is time for the food movement to become political and have Congress represent us. And we also know that our members of Congress are being lobbied constantly by other agendas or entities with other agendas. There is a particular group, it's called the Coalition for Safe, Affordable Food. And when I first heard that name, I thought it was probably a group of organizations like EWG or the Food Revolution Network. But in fact, the Coalition for Safe, Affordable Food is something quite different. It's a newly formed industry front group that's trying to push legislation through Congress today that would let companies label food with GMO ingredients as natural. Now, it seems that the companies making billions from selling us highly processed food will stop at nothing to hide basic information about what's in the foods that we eat. Are they also proposing legislation that would make it impossible for any state to require labeling of genetically engineered foods?
Yes, they are. I mean, the audacity of this effort is a little bit breathtaking to me anyway. These big food companies have decided that the best way for them to protect the status quo is to legislate it. In other contexts, of course, they want the government to get off their backs at every turn. But when it comes to this upstart movement of consumers who simply want to know if the food they're buying has GMOs in it, that seems intolerable to these food companies, and so they've gone to Congress. They've said, let us continue to slap the natural label on really just about anything. It can be a food that's full of artificial ingredients, full of hormones and antibiotics or used to produce the food, and, of course, can have genetically engineered ingredients. They've asked for all of that to be allowed to continue by law, and they're also at the same time saying, Congress, you've got to help us cut off this consumer interest in having food labeled that's springing up in state after state. We've had a ballot measure in California, another one in Washington State, and Oregon's coming up now in this coming year. It'll be voted on. In all of those instances, the industry has spent $4 or $5 or more dollars for every dollar that's been spent on our side to try and get labeling enabled through legislation. And the companies are tired of spending that money. So they've just gone to their good friends in Congress and said, we'd like you to sponsor legislation that would cut off the ability of the states to do this. We'd like you to support legislation that would forever require, as a matter of law, that we'd be able to sell just about anything we wanted to sell with a natural label on it, including food with genetically engineered ingredients. So, again, I like to think that this is overreaching on the part of the industry, that the American people are way too smart and will understand that it really should be their decision to purchase food according to what they prefer the ingredients to be and the makeup of it and the origins of it, and that transparency is a good thing, not less.
EWG is helping in this effort. We have now 64 countries, including Japan, almost every nation in the European Union, Australia, Brazil, Russia, even China, all have laws that require foods with genetically engineered ingredients to be labeled. But the U.S. is the only industrialized nation in the world that does not. Now, EWG has recently released a shopper's guide to avoiding genetically engineered food. Why did you create this guide?
Well, we created it because, unfortunately, we don't have the right in this country to know that, as you mentioned, 60-plus other countries' citizens do have. They have their government standing up for them and saying, look, we're not saying you can't eat genetically engineered food. We're not banning genetically engineered ingredients. What we are saying is if you decide you'd like to know that, you have a right to know it. And so we're going to require companies to put it on the label. In some cases, in Europe and elsewhere, you don't see much genetically engineered food showing up with those labels because the companies opt to produce the food without it. It'd be easy to do in the United States, too. We have plenty of non-GMO grain and oil seeds and other source material to produce packaged foods without genetically engineered ingredients. That's beyond question. But basically, we just decided, look, this is another case where the government has failed. The government won't stand up for us. It's going to stand up for the interests of the special interests, the food companies, the pesticide companies, the biotech companies. As long as that's the case, let's at least put a guide out there. And there are others that have been put out by other organizations that lets people decide for themselves, gives them some guidelines to be able to work their way through the grocery store and, by and large, if they choose to, reduce, if not avoid, the consumption of genetically engineered ingredients.
Speaking of labeling, I think of how organic growers have to pay to get certification to prove that they aren't using pesticides and other forbidden inputs. And then they label those foods as organic, whereas other foods grown with pesticides aren't labeled in any particular way. I would love to see it switched so that foods that are grown with pesticides, be they herbicides, insecticides, whatever kind of pesticide has been applied to the growing plant or used in the livestock production, that had to be listed. That had to be on the label. I think that would change things quite radically. I don't expect that realistically to happen anytime soon, but I do like envisioning it because it makes me feel that we actually could move in the same direction.
You know, it's a great example, and you've really put your finger on it, of what we would do if we really wanted a system that was incentivized by government policy to produce the kinds of food that we want in adequate amounts versus the system we now have, which is incentivizing overproduction of a lot of foods that aren't good for the planet and aren't good for our health. But you're right, exactly. I mean, it's the same way with farm subsidies. We spend billions of dollars on these industrial crops and pennies by comparison on research and marketing and promotion of local and organic food. We spend billions of dollars to develop biotech crops, but very modest amounts of money to help organic producers figure out pest problems without chemicals. So this is a perfect example, John. I agree with you. We probably won't be seeing your idea come to fruition too soon just because of the powers that are arrayed against a more sensible system. But I am given some hope that across the political spectrum, there are some common precepts. People don't want their tax dollars squandered. They don't like the idea of money being wasted and given to people who are already doing very well. They share a lot of our values about needing to provide support for hungry people. Some of them are children, particularly people who have, through no fault of their own, just happened to lose their job because a factory shut down or moved overseas. All of those values have some pretty common appeal across the political spectrum. We have a lot of conservative Republicans who are worried about wasteful spending in farm subsidy programs who might feel much better about investing some of that money in local food production. We have conservative politicians who don't like the idea of having hungry kids not performing well in school, causing excessive medical expenses or, in some cases, being malnourished, and that can mean overweight, of course, to the extent that they are not fit for the military service. So there are lots of ways in which we can find common ground here, and my feeling is that ideas like reversing what it is we charge to prove, such as organic farmers shouldn't have to be paying fees to prove they're organic, we ought to be charging fees to the big agricultural operations in the Midwest that are polluting our drinking water. Right now they're not paying a penny, and we're cleaning up drinking water in every major state capital in the Midwest that has weed killers in it every spring. No payments coming from farmers for that. So I think you're on to something there. We need to reverse the signals to produce a food system that is giving us exactly what we want and not the problems that we have now in abundance with our current system.
Well, Ken, the contribution that you and EWUG have made and continue to make to the health of our world is immeasurable. It's been powerful, it's been effectual, and we all have reason to be grateful to you for what you've been doing for so long, and I know we'll continue to do. And it's been today, as always, a real pleasure to speak with you. And on behalf of everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I thank you, Ken. I thank EWG for being one of the environmental community's most effective critics of industrial agriculture, and also for being one of our foremost allies in the effort to create healthy food and a healthy world.
John, the pleasure is all mine, as ever, and thank you for leading this food revolution. I don't know where we'd be without you and Ocean leading the way here, and congratulations on all of that great work.
We've been talking with Ken Cook, the president of Environmental Working Group, and one of the leading educators and advocates for healthy food for all of us. Ken, I think it's fair to say that we live in a pretty toxic food culture. And in that context, you are a beacon of truth and a brilliant advocate of possibility. You're a friend and a trusted ally to millions of people and to our very planet itself. We want to thank you for your time, for your wisdom, and for your incredibly important work on behalf of the food revolution.
Ocean, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to join you today.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get these members-only courses and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. To express your opinions on all that you've been hearing and to find out what other people are saying, you can post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. Make sure to refresh your page in order to see the most recent comments. This now concludes day 3 of the Food Revolution Summit. Come back and join us tomorrow for Restoring Our Humanity, a more ethical world, one bite at a time. We'll be hearing from Dr. Jane Goodall on the human-animal bond, Wayne Pacelli on how to build a more humane world, and Jonathan Safran Foer on why humans have a stake in the way that animals are treated. Until tomorrow, we're wishing you health, happiness, and lots of good food.